Nice to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Starting the program today by taking a look at energy policy in Wisconsin and the United States. What do our presidential candidates have to say, or what have they said? How much have they said? Not a lot, I don't think. Well, we'll find out. Professor Michael Corradini is our guest today from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He chairs the Nuclear Engineering and Engineering Physics here at the UW, and we're pleased to have him back again to talk with us. And today, zeroing in on energy policy. If you have a question or a comment, would like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Mike Corradini, welcome back. Nice to have you with us
again. Thank you, Larry. Nice to be back.
Let's start with Wisconsin. Governor Doyle, his panel on global warming voted last Thursday for a major 26-3, I think the vote was, for a series of measures to cut greenhouse gas emissions in Wisconsin. They want to triple or quadruple the investment in energy efficiency, expand power from wind turbines and other renewables, maybe build some turbines in the Great Lakes, and some other things as well. Can you comment on those?
Well, I think one of the members that the director of our Energy Institute at the UW was on their technical advisory group, helping them in some of the analysis. I think most of the recommendations are quite reasonable. I would say that I haven't read the final report. I've been reading a lot of their comments and analysis as it's been going along. I think a lot of their suggestions are very reasonable and quite doable. I think a lot of these things, though, are more than just within the state. That is, it's going to take states in regions and the U.S. as a whole to really enact this. I mean, the biggest one that pops in my head is the concept of having more wind power, which I think is very good. The difficulty many times with wind is that you have to connect it through the grid, and that means transmission lines, which means you've got to deal with both the technology of getting the transmission lines up and the legal siting and regulatory concerns about getting it from point A to point B, where at least in the northern Midwest, South Dakota is the place where there's the best place for it, but it's very difficult to get the transmission lines to where you might want to take the wind. And there's other ones, but that's an example of one that pops up. So I think things are not just environmental. There are a lot of things that are quite broad in terms of how they have to be dealt with.
Yeah, and I guess there's some resistance to this, and I know at least in the assembly.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure that I know enough about that. I've not spoken since the governor's task force has been completed with some people in the assembly that I usually speak to about it and their concerns. So I haven't heard anything written on specific concerns.
As we think about our national energy policy, do we have a coherent national energy policy?
Well,
if we do, what is it?
Well, I think I guess I'm a bit of a pragmatist here. I think because energy has been so cheap that we say we do, and it once in a while a publication comes up. When the current administration essentially was sworn in back in 2001, I think we actually, there's a document on energy policy that the vice president commissioned a group, which then turned into a big what I'll call somewhat of a controversy because they wouldn't release who they spoke to. But in any case, there was an energy policy statement at the time. Probably the closest to a coherent, thoughtful group that's done this, I pulled it up on the web. I figured you're going to ask me this. There's the National Commission on Energy Policy. And in fact, if people want to look at it, you can go to just energycommission.org. And this is a group of about 15 individuals, three co-chairs, John Rowe, who is our alum, actually, from UW, chairman of the board of Exelon. I think it's Timothy O'Reilly. It's Mr. O'Reilly, former EPA commissioner, and John Holdren, a professor of policy at Harvard, co-chaired a group of 15 individuals. And they've been in existence now for 4 years. They put together their first report on what should be an appropriate energy policy for the U.S. in 2004, and they continue to put out kind of, I'll say, publications, position papers, white papers mm-hmm. since that time. They have a very comprehensive view of things. And if I were to tell anybody to read something that's very balanced
yeah.
for energy conservation, efficiency, production, it's a very good group. That's where I think I would look immediately. And in fact, I think both campaigns have looked there.
They have. Oh,
yeah, I think actually.
A good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a very good thing. I think I might be incorrect about this, but I think the one of the energy policy folks, leaders for the Obama campaign, is the former executive director of the commission, and I think on the McCain side, two of the members of the commission itself are direct advisors to Senator McCain. So I think both groups, and I think this is a good thing, both mm-hmm. groups have looked into that as a way to look at a balanced approach on energy.
We'll take some calls. You can join in with your comments at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Have Senator McCain and Senator Obama, have they developed really an energy policy yet?
Well, I've watched the debates when they were rolling up to the point of being soon-to-be candidates for
yeah.
both parties. And you hear various, I call it snippets or short kind of statements. I don't see any side just yet in having a comprehensive energy policy. There's certain things you hear on production from Senator McCain, certain things you hear about on renewables from Senator Obama. But I don't view either side as got a complete comprehensive policy. But I think this is becoming more important in the mm-hmm. last few months, primarily because of the cost of energy has gone up, and now people are paying attention again.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's take some calls. We can talk some more about that, but Paul in New Berlin has a question for you. Paul, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Yeah. Regarding nuclear energy, it's three-faceted. What is the technology now? I've heard that people advocate breaking down the waste and reutilizing the waste to get more and more energy out so it's finally just neutralized. What's the technology on that? What is the long-range supply of uranium on the planet? And if you could comment on the wisdom of creating greater dependencies on non-sustainable sources of energy.
Okay. All good questions. So let me take your second question first. Based on today's use worldwide and what people know to be the reserves, and reserves has a very specific meaning in the world of geologists, which means you actually did some drilling somewhere and you know the concentration, you know how much it's cost to dig it up. Given today's, there's 440 nuclear power plants in the world, and with what people are seeing, the growth, which is about, I'll call it a few plants, three or four plants coming online every year, they're estimating about 100 years for the current uranium reserves, all right? So I use the word very carefully there. To your first question, so just one other thing about that, that actually is not of a short time. Right now, with the way we use coal, and China is using coal at enormously rapidly increasing rate, there's about 100 to 150 to 200 years of known coal reserves. So the two most plentiful resources in terms of fuels that you have to dig up and then use are on that order. In terms of waste neutralization, I guess the first thing we all should be aware of is that any form of energy produces a byproduct, all right, a byproduct emission or something we have to dispose of. Each form is a bit different. In nuclear's case, as you said, you generate spent fuel. There is a proposal now in front of the current administration to start reprocessing fuel, which would reduce the amount of high-level waste, which is what people call that has to be eventually buried. But it'll reduce it. It will not eliminate it. So I think to answer your question precisely is that instead of burying everything, including that could be recycled, you'd bury about 1%, 2%, or 3% of that material eventually if you start reprocessing. And I only stop there and say that France and Japan currently are reprocessing. As to your last question about non-sustainable, I guess that's more of a policy question. I think we all have an opinion. My view is, personally, that we're always going to have an energy mix, and to have baseload electricity, which we tend to use a lot of in the United States, and all other countries that seem to want to be like us, use more and more electricity. Baseload electricity is primarily produced by either coal or nuclear or hydro. And that'll probably stay that way for many decades. So we really have to deal with an appropriate way of dealing with baseload electricity and the energy sources. I hope I've at least quickly answered your question.
Thank you. As far as the long range, though, if we don't start weaning ourselves from this idea of consuming finite resources, when can we get onto a truly sustainable type of program? Well,
okay, so now you've entered the world of philosophy. So I'll let you define what sustainable is. But when people say sustainable, I think what they think of is that it's never ending. But nothing's never ending. It's a matter of the time scale. And so I think your first question about resources is very important. Is that it depends what you view as long time or forever.
We can last as long as the sun does. So when the sun goes out, there's still possibly people on Earth to phase out at that time.
Then we're talking millions of years.
There you go.
But I will point out to us that I worry most about, and just so I kind of broaden this a bit, the one thing that was said by both candidates, and I guess to both their credits, is that in sometimes I'm not so much worried about the environment as much as I am simultaneously worried about energy security. And I really do think that we're more and more becoming an insecure situation in the United States because we're relying on foreign sources for a lot of our energy. And it's not just the fuel. If you look at it, all the technologies for wind turbines, the leading company is in Denmark. So I can take any sort of technology. And what concerns me is the fact that we are relying too much, I think, on foreign sources, either for our fuel or for our technology, and that's something that we really have to address.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The numbers of consumers, I suppose, enters into the equation also.
Well, if we want to control the population, we can control our energy.
There you go.
But I think you've actually brought up something that's important for the general public to realize, is that the reason we have energy growth is that the population continues to grow, and China, India, Brazil look to us as a standard of living and a method of living that they aspire to do. Therefore, their energy grows much faster than ours because they want to be like us.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Professor Michael Corradini, our guest today, he is a UW-Madison Chair of Nuclear Engineering and Engineering Physics, talking with us about energy policy here in Wisconsin and in the United States. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking energy policy in Wisconsin and the United States today with Professor Michael Corradini of the UW-Madison Nuclear Engineering and Engineering Physics. And pleased to have him with us today. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Don in Richland Center has a question or comment. Don, hello to you.
Hello, sir. Appreciate the program.
Thank you.
I have seen several of my neighbors who have installed geothermal heat pumps, ground-to-air type heat pumps, and it appears to me that based on their energy savings for heating and cooling and hot water, that everybody ought to do that. It seems like it's one of those pretty inexhaustible sources of energy, and I realize it takes electricity to drive the pumps, but energy is pretty fungible, and if we save natural gas or propane that we can use for generation of electricity, and then save 60% or 70% on heating and cooling costs, it just looks like a great trade-off to me.
Well, what do you think, Mike?
No, I think the caller, I've forgotten his name, I apologize.
Oh, Don.
Don. I think that's actually a very good point. We actually had here a speaker from Alliant Energy talking about geothermal as an appropriate form to use. I guess I'd just say to folks out there that they've got to think clearly, because the cost, the actual capital cost of a new, you use the proper terminology, but what I'll call a shallow geothermal heat pump can be fairly pricey. So you want to make a clear decision that you want to make that capital investment, even with energy credits or energy incentives for renewables. But just to give some people some facts, right? I talked to a geology professor here, in Professor Carroll in geology, and he corrected me. But we get about the equivalent of 10% of the solar flux nonstop from the Earth due to geothermal. And that's all due to radioactive decay, just so people realize. Mm-hmm. That the natural radioactive elements in the Earth's crust continually release energy, and that's where we're getting our geothermal from. So it's a very good source. It just tends to be very capital intensive in your initial installation. But I think the caller is very true, about very clear and correct about how this is a very interesting available source to all of us.
Thanks, Don, for calling. Appreciate it. Nathaniel in Milwaukee, we'll turn to you next. Hi.
Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to actually potentially add a little bit on to perhaps two prior callers.
Okay.
One was about population control, and I think that is a little bit odd. And I say that because when you talk about population control, you're talking about measuring the number of people, not the actual amount of pollution they put out. And it's kind of like trying to count money by counting the number of bills rather than the value on them.
I would agree.
You would agree with that?
Yeah, I wasn't trying to imply anything about population control. I was simply pointing out that historically, that if you look at energy growth as and population, they tend to go hand in hand. In the developing countries, as the population grows, which is the growth rate is decreasing, still their energy growth tracks it very closely. And on top of it, they want to increase, as they view it, their standard of living, which also causes their energy growth to go up.
Yeah.
So that was my only point.
Okay. All right.
Okay. One other thing that I want to mention in addition to that is, since you were talking about geothermal, and fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, Wisconsin does not have a supervolcano located under its territory somewhere. However, in the West, they do. Considering that when this thing goes, if it ever does in the future, it'll be catastrophic, wouldn't it make sense to perhaps tap it both so that it can sort of release pressure more smoothly, and we could potentially get energy benefits out of that?
I'm not a geologist. I'm going to give Larry a name of somebody that he can have on this one. So I'm going to try a couple of things and then stop so I don't get myself in trouble. I think the first thing is about geothermal is the very fact that you have continual heat release in the ground. You don't have to go very far down. You can go down 12 feet, and you'll notice the temperature stays relatively constant as the day passes and as the seasons pass. If you go down now 100 feet, as the previous caller, Don, was saying, and you get this kind of shallow geothermal well, then you're essentially extracting the heat that's normally radiating out anyway and being lost, and that's what you use essentially as your heat source, right, mm-hmm. for your heat pump. But what you're asking is your second part of your question is out of my expertise, and I would say Mother Nature is a whole lot stronger than we are, so I'd be very careful of what I tried to tap.
All right. Thanks, Nathaniel, for calling. And we'll turn to another caller. Let's go to Ladd in Hazelhurst next. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm curious as to why I haven't heard anybody speak of thorium-based nuclear power.
Well, primarily because we have a lot of uranium that the U.S. uses. But let me back up and say that the country you want to look at, if you want to see that's using that, is India. India has an enormous amount of thorium resources within their continental boundaries. And they actually are building some of their nuclear reactor plants are using thorium as their base fuel. But within the U.S., it's somewhat impractical because the only source of thorium is in the relatively populated areas of the northeast United States. I don't think people are going to be very thrilled about us digging there. All the uranium resources tend to be in the Rocky Mountains, which is very low population and very close to the surface. So it's cheaper to dig up. But what the caller is saying is absolutely right. There are thorium-based fuel cycles, and thorium actually, from a purely waste standpoint, is a bit better than uranium in terms of what it gives up as its byproduct waste. But I think it's more practicalities of where it is, how much it costs to extract it.
Okay.
May I interject something here?
Sure.
Thorium is non-prolific. So if we use thorium thorium-based power for our plants, we would not have the issue of nuclear bombs like Iran if they were using thorium instead. I know we have a company here called Thorium Power in the country who is working on it quite heavily to use it in commercial facilities. They're working with Russia. They are working with India. The United Arab Emirates, they're working with them. And again, I don't understand why the U.S. isn't more involved in it. Sure, maybe we don't have as much of a supply, but India does have a huge supply. We could be using India's supply for our purposes. I just, again, I don't understand why our government isn't more involved in it.
So I'm going to try this one on you. So this is, in theory, as a nuclear engineer, I'm supposed to know the answer to this. So it's a bit more complicated because for thorium to be utilized properly, and I apologize for a little bit of physics here, you actually transmute it into uranium-233, which is actually what is fissioned and releases the energy for the power plant. So you're right that if I could somehow get to a steady state situation, I could dig up the thorium, stick it in the reactor, it would turn it into uranium-233, and then it would immediately split up and use the energy. That's true. The problem is that you have to start this all off with something that actually is useful, which means you have to add uranium into the mix to begin with, and then you still have the same waste problem. So I think how you phrased it is correct if everybody was working off of it, but you still need uranium to start these plants off. If you're interested further, probably the best work that's ever been done on this was done by the Naval Reactors Program here in the United States back about 20 years ago, and they actually developed and designed and built and operated a thorium-fueled reactor. I think it really just comes down to cost. I don't think your proliferation concerns are that much alleviated because you have to use uranium to start off all these plants.
Huh, interesting. Thanks, Ladd, for calling. I want to give some others a chance to join in here. I appreciate your comments and questions. George in Madison has a question or comment. George, hello.
Hello. Thank you to both of you. And I'm a former student of Dr. Corradini. I want to talk
George.
About geothermal a little bit because it was brought up and it shows the confusion about energy that is so problematic. First of all, you had two calls in a row. One defined geothermal as using a heat pump to take energy out of the ground just below the surface. The other one started defining it as what we have out west, where we tap the hot earth. And most people get confused between the two. We don't have the second one, the tapping, as Dr. Corradini talked about. But the first one actually did a study for Focus on Energy, and Larry's familiar with them, on geothermal heat pump using in homes. They could get it at the Energy Center of Wisconsin website. And basically, it's not as cost as the payback is very long. Let's look at it that way. And people think that, yes, they get their bills down, but they don't realize they have to pay $15,000 extra to put it in or something like that. And so, people really have to do research before assuming any energy solution is a solution. Because it's just way too complicated, not only among the technologies, but what information is out there.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with George. I know him very well. I do think, though, the one thing George says that I'll emphasize is I think people have to be, you have to weigh what you value. And so, and George will jump in if he disagrees, which is part of it is the economics. What are you willing to pay up front in terms of installing something and how much do you value it on, as George says, payback, which is fuel savings, or I might value the environment to the point that even if it is not economic, I'm still willing to do it because anyway. Of how it affects, how I view it affects the environment. But I think everything, the way George has framed it is right on the money.
Can I say something about the environment?
Go ahead.
All right. And this is the exact technology that is confusing to people. If you pull that study down, you're going to see that I found that geothermal heat pumps in homes are within the margin of error, a bad for the environment, at least in the mix of fuels we had for generation at that time, less good for the environment than a natural gas furnace. Now, that's changing as we get more green electricity, of course, and the report even says that. But the point is, a lot of people are saying, well, I want to help the environment, and when they call me up and I say, well, then burn natural gas at this point unless you're going to buy green energy. There's a way around it. So even the environmental issue is very confusing, and people really need to research that.
All right. George, I think, and Mike Cordini is shaking his head yes in agreement. So thank you very much
for nodding in agreement, I should say. I would say that George and I talk a lot offline, and so we have a lot of agreements and disagreements, but he's very good in his analysis, so I think that's important for the audience.
Thanks, George, for calling. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And let's turn next to Tony in Juneau. Tony, hello.
Hi there. I'll just take a minute here. With all the talk about energy, I'm amazed at the education still yet needed by the general public. I think there remains only one long-lasting solution to our problem, and one, I say, renewable energy. Renewable energy only. There's a lot of different sources we can use for renewable energy, but everything else, oil, uranium, they talked about thorium, you talk about gas, and everything else comes, is really concentrated, stored energy that is there from our sun or other sources that will eventually all be used up. Now, when we talk about corn, you know, I mean, that comes from the sun. It's something that we grow, and that, I think, is just as ridiculous. We have to turn to renewable sources like the sun, solar, hydro, which the sun uses to raise the rain, and then it comes down, and we can use that energy. Geothermally, which will eventually be used up, obviously, a long time away. Tidal forces. These are all things that we can use now, and when people talk about, well, it's so expensive, it's affordable, there's more ignorance there. Everything gets cheaper when mass-produced in a competitive market. I don't understand why, and we see that all the time. I bought a calculator for $200 30 years ago. Now I can get it for $1 in the line at the grocery store.
Mike, any comment?
Well, I mean, I would say we're back to time scale and what you're willing to spend in the interim. I think if I went to the general public, I think people would do some sort of economic calculation and might choose something different in the next few years to decades. I guess the one thing I'll say, which I was waiting for somebody to call in, but I might as well say it now, it all depends on how you want to affect the environment or your pocketbook. Probably the cheapest way to affect your pocketbook and still improve the environment is to conserve or to get more efficient. So, which means you invest in a better refrigerator, you invest in a more efficient furnace for your home. I would say air conditioners here, but luckily we don't use them as much as other people do around the country. And efficiency and conservation probably is the best starting point. And it's actually relatively inexpensive. And then beyond that, in time scale, I do think that certain forms of renewables are very cost competitive. But I use that word cost competitive because most people will look at their pocketbook, do some sort of calculation, decide how much do I want to invest versus how much I want to assist in the environmental concerns.
And thanks very much for calling. Someone called in and wondered, or sent an email and wondered if France is getting nuclear energy from the sea.
Well, they probably mean, are they getting their fuel, their uranium from the sea? The answer is no. The French buy most of their uranium from the Australians, like we do. It turns out the two places in the world which have the largest resources and the cheapest way to remove them is in Canada and in Australia. And most countries purchase their uranium from there. But I think the email probably implied that the largest source of uranium in the world is in the sea, dissolved. And it's actually a relatively non-negligible concentration. It's just very expensive to extract. The Japanese actually are the ones that are doing the most work on extracting uranium from the sea.
Okay, so right from the water itself.
Right, right. It's dissolved, like all minerals are, in the sea. And if you go through almost like, my best example is almost like your water softener. You essentially get some sort of very specific resin. You can capture the uranium and then remove it from the solid particles, and there you got it. But but it's a relatively expensive process compared to digging it up from the ground. But there's an enormous amount. So that's why I started this whole thing off with the first caller about calling it reserves and calling a certain cost per unit, because if you look at the sea, it's there for, yeah, if you want to spend the money, it's there for a very, very long time. It's inexhaustible.
Quick to explain, but hard to really do in practice.
Yeah. Well, at a reasonable cost.
At a reasonable cost, yeah. Well, you know, we've caught a lot of different topics here have come up. And what do you think Senator McCain, Senator Obama, you know, in terms of their own policies, are they... Will they be taking everything into all these things into account, or what?
My impression is from listening, and again, I just urge all the voters, all the people out there to listen as they go through, I guess, debates or town meetings or whatever they're going to do. I think you have to listen closely, because my sense of it is that both of them are fairly reasonable about what they're going to consider. That is, although you hear Senator Obama talking about renewables, I've heard talks where he's said for base load electricity, we're going to have to, and he wants to use nuclear as well as clean coal, all right? And conversely, although you hear Senator McCain's public or snippet comments, whatever, one-liners are about oil drilling off the coast, he's spoken quite extensively about the need for renewables as part of the mix, right, as well as conservation and efficiency. So I think both are we haven't seen all of their policies, but I think both, if you listen enough, you get a wider range of what are the possibilities, and they're very broad.
And Justin, you mentioned offshore oil. Do we have any idea, do we know how much oil is out there, or what would have any idea of
the... I guess the answer is I'm back to geology. I'm not a geologist. Yeah. I recommend you bring in Dr. Carroll. But my quick answer is they did go through, and they now have a number of offshore deep rigs in the Gulf of Mexico, and they've estimated there about 15 billion barrels or maybe 20 billion barrels. But if you do the quick calculation, that gives us an extra 3 years of oil at the rate we consume it. So it's partly our consumption rate is so tremendous. And there was a piece on, in fact, many of the listeners probably do this. I was listening to CNN Channel 2, I guess, CNN 2, where T. Boone Pickens was giving testimony in front of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee in the Senate. And he did a very nice job of discussing what the resources are, both onshore and offshore in the U.S., and because we use so much of it so quickly, how little this adds to the total mix. So relying on oil and more fines only, I think, is just as inappropriate as relying on any one source.
Any one source, yeah. Well, some people question or say that the question of nuclear power is to some extent irrelevant because advances in solar power are progressing fast enough to make it viable before Congress would ever get the first nuclear plant or the next nuclear plant built. You know, they're saying the solar technology you can apply it to existing homes and so forth. And what's your response on that?
Well, I guess I was guessing we might come this way, so I got some statistics. So I'll just use the last 10 years, and the people out there can check me if they don't believe me. In the last 10 years, we have 104 nuclear power plants in the U.S. We'll have actually another one coming online. They're rebuilding one that was stopped in the 80s. But we have 104 plants. And the thing that's happening right now in all those plants is they run very reliably about 90% of the time for baseload electricity. But on top of that, most of the utilities find that they have, from an engineering standpoint, margin that they can actually increase the power. So in the last 10 years, we have increased the power of those 104 plants by something like 5,000 megawatts electric, give or take 4,500 megawatts electric. All right. That means we're producing 100% of the time throughout the year an additional 4,500 megawatts electric from those plants by just re-engineering how they produce the power. Okay. In that same time period, we've installed a lot of wind, we've installed a lot of solar, but because it's intermittent and not dispatchable, we actually have produced more new nuclear electricity by those uprates that I just talked about than all the wind and all the solar we've installed in the same 10 years.
Wow.
Okay? So we've essentially built four more power plants without building any power plants. And so I think in the next 10 years, you're going to see the same thing, that probably the two, and again, I say this a bit provocatively, that you'll probably see uprates and increases in power by re-engineering the systems, investing in the current plants, changing out small equipment, putting in larger equipment, right? What you normally do as an engineer, and we'll probably see enormous growth in the amount of electricity we produce by nuclear simply by the current 104. What I think you were asking is now there's about a dozen applications in front of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to build new plants. I think those will come on slowly, because building anything new in the United States will come on slowly. We haven't built an oil refinery in the United States since 1972. The newest oil refinery is in Joliet, Illinois, right, just south of us here. And I just drove by it last week when I was visiting a nuclear power plant, and it's an enormous facility. All they've done is add capacity, just what we're doing in nuclear power. So building anything new in the United States is very difficult, because it takes time and it's very person intensive. That is, you need a lot of infrastructure to do it. And so we're not going to see, even though you have a dozen, you're not going to see more than, I'd say, a few every so often in the next 10 some years.
But we will see quite a bit with the existing. We'll be seeing lots of changes in the existing plants.
Right. And I think the one bit of renewables you'll probably see coming up will be solar thermal. There's a couple of demonstration plants in Colorado and in Arizona and in the deserts of California that they're trying to get at a reasonable cost. And it essentially is a power plant with using radiation from the sun and then reflecting it to a power cycle.
Oh, so that's, and that's in, that's
those
underway.
Are demonstration plants. There's one in Colorado. There's one that used to be in Arizona and one in California that they're now doing work on, and they're planning to build some as more demonstration plants.
Interesting. Mike, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope you can come back and be with us again.
Anytime.
Lots of great questions here, and I'm sorry we didn't get to everyone, but that's pretty much always the case. Professor Michael Corradini chairs nuclear engineering and engineering physics at the University of Wisconsin Madison, and we'll have him back and we'll talk some more about energy and energy policy here in the state and across the nation. Coming up, we'll be taking a look at our state's largest and most significant rivers with Doris Green. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.